Well, good evening. Open your Bibles to the book of Joshua. And we're getting a belated start to our material this quarter. That's okay. Appreciate the elders letting me have last week off, and thank Kyle Hall for teaching last Wednesday night. And now we're going to go ahead and get started. Joshua chapters 1 and 2, that's our goal for tonight. We're going to work our way through the entire book this quarter. Let me start with a couple of questions. What's the first thing that comes to your mind when we say Joshua, either the man or the book? First thing, Teresa?
This day who you shall serve.
Okay, yeah, 24:15, that great saying we have, and a lot of us have it posted in our house somewhere. Choose for your day, for yourselves who you will serve. As for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. Great saying from Joshua in his farewell speech at the end. We'll get to that. What else comes to mind? Jericho. Okay, yeah, we're going to start getting to that in chapter 2 with Rahab, and then the walls fall down in chapter 6. Okay, what else? Okay, yeah, dare to stand like Joshua. So he's known for his courage, his bravery, a lot of fights and battles in this book, and so he's having to go conquer the land, lead them in the conquest of the land. So dare to stand like Joshua. We'll see in chapter 1 that God keeps telling him, be strong and courageous. Good. Is this the first time we have encountered the man Joshua? No, we've been reading about him. Wyatt?
The earliest that I remember him mentioned, because as he was one of the 12 spies,
yeah.
That's the chapters 13 and 14 are when that happens.
Yeah, numbers 13 and 14 is one of the two faithful spies, Caleb and Joshua. And then before that, you know, I didn't look it up where we first read about him, but I think he's back in Exodus, isn't he? He's on the mountain with Moses, Mount Sinai. And so we've been reading about him for a while. And then now here he is, and he's taking the helm of the nation now. God's putting him in charge to lead the nation in this pitiful, in this ultimate time where they're fulfilling the promise and entering the land. What do we know about this generation of Israelites? They were born
in the wilderness.
Yeah, so their parents are the ones that died off. They were punished. They're unfaithful. So God said, well, your corpses are going to fall into the wilderness. And so this would be the survivors then, the kids that are now grown up. And they're the ones that are going to actually enter the land. So they have seen a lot, and they've been wandering a long time. And the ones that were already alive, some of them would have been alive back in Egypt, back when they were kids. And so they have seen a bunch of miracles, the 10 plagues, crossing the Red Sea, all of that stuff. They've seen a lot, and now it's their time to shine. It's their time to conquer the land. Okay, look back in Deuteronomy, actually, chapter 34 and verse 5. So Moses, the servant of the Lord, died there in the land of Moab according to the word of the Lord. Okay, so Deuteronomy ends. Moses dies. You see in verse 9, now Joshua, the son of Nun, was filled with the spirit of wisdom, for Moses had laid his hands on him, and the sons of Israel listened to him and did as the Lord had commanded Moses. Okay, so it's kind of the passing of the torch. Moses had laid his hands on Joshua. Joshua is taking the lead in the nation now and leading them. Okay, let's look in Joshua chapter 1 and verse 1. Now, it came about after the death of Moses, the servant of the Lord, that the Lord spoke to Joshua, the son of Nun, Moses' servant, saying, Moses, my servant, is dead. Now, therefore, arise, cross this Jordan, you and all this people, to the land which I am giving to them, to the sons of Israel. Every place on which the sole of your foot treads, I have given it to you, just as I spoke to Moses. From the wilderness and this Lebanon, even as far as the river Euphrates, all the land of the Hittites, and as far as the great sea toward the setting of the sun, will be your territory. No man will be able to stand before you all the days of your life. Just as I have been with Moses, I will be with you. I will not fail you or forsake you. Okay, so Joshua is going to lead them into the promised land. This is God speaking to Joshua and telling him all of this. Notice how verses 2, 3, and 4, he's referring to the land promise. The land promise. So if you want to put a marker there, go back to Genesis chapter 12. Just a quick reminder, the land promise. We're talking about all of this starting way back here in Genesis chapter 12. Where God appears to Abram, and he makes some promises. And one of them is this, in verse 7, Genesis 12 and verse 7. The Lord appeared to Abram and said, to your descendants I will give this land. Okay, so that is going to be fulfilled in the book of Joshua. Then later they're going to lose the land, and then they're going to be restored to the land. But it's going to be fulfilled here in the book of Joshua. Okay, so back to our text then in Joshua. So it starts back then in Genesis 12 with this promise, and we're seeing the fulfillment of that. The book of Joshua is revealing how this is being accomplished, that they're moving into the land. There's a bunch of other nations that are living there that are worshiping idols and doing evil things, and God is going to have his people come in, conquer them, and start living in that land. So this is centuries later, but God's fulfilling his promise. Actually, we could say it started before Genesis 12:7. I mean, this is part of God's overarching plan to save humanity. And so we can read about that being planned in the mind of God before the world began. So you could say before Genesis 1:1, God's already planning all this stuff out in his mind. We speak God's wisdom in a mystery, the hidden wisdom which God predestined before the ages to our glory. 1 Corinthians 2 and verse 7. So this is all part of the bigger picture, which is God providing salvation to humanity. So he decided, I'm going to do that. I'm going to provide salvation through my son. He's going to come live on the planet and be a sacrifice, a blood sacrifice for the sins of everybody. He decides to create a nation of people who will give birth to that son. And so he had the nation of Israel formed from the descendants of Abraham. And then he decided to give that nation a portion of land in which to live. And that's what we're reading about in the book of Joshua. So if we zoom way out, that's the big picture. God is accomplishing his plan. It's a wonderful thing. And one of the great things we'll get out of reading this book is not just, oh, look at these battles ahead, but the big picture is God's fulfilling his plan. We can trust him and we can love him for his provisions for us, just like what he did here for the nation of Israel and essentially for all of mankind. Okay, let me pause there. Comments, questions on anything so far? Okay, so those three promises to Abraham in Genesis 12, and it's thousands of years in the making that God is creating this pathway to heaven. Look back in chapter 1 and verse 6. Be strong and courageous. Okay, there's the usage of that phrase. Be strong and courageous. For you shall give this people possession of the land which I swore to their fathers to give them. Only be strong and very courageous. There it is again. Be careful to do according to all the law which Moses, my servant, commanded you. Do not turn from it to the right or to the left so that you may have success wherever you go. This book of the law shall not depart from your mouth, but you shall meditate on it day and night so that you may be careful to do according to all that is written in it. For then you will make your way prosperous, and then you will have success. Have I not commanded you? Be strong and courageous. Do not tremble or be dismayed, for the Lord your God is with you wherever you go. So here's God talking to Joshua, and you notice three times, be strong and courageous. So apparently he needed to be strong and courageous in the things that are about to confront him in the next period of time here. So Joshua's going to be fighting. It's one thing to say, okay, go to the tabernacle and worship God. And that's a demonstration of faith, and that's a great expression of our sincerity and our love for God and not knocking that at all. But now these people, and Joshua is the leader of these people, is being told, get your sword and go on the battlefield. Okay, so now it's talking about faith, which the previous generation did not have. They did not want to go. They've got a bunch of big old people and big old walls in these cities, and we don't want to go over there. And so now this generation is being challenged. Okay, can you do it? Get your swords on and get on the battlefield. And so he's telling the leader here, God's telling Joshua, be strong and courageous. That's another level of faith. That's another level of courage to go out there and actually put your sword on and run to the battle. And a great lesson there for us. I mean, figuratively, we're in battle. The New Testament is describing New Testament Christians as we're at war. Satan's the enemy, and we're fighting a spiritual battle. Over in Ephesians chapter 6, you think about, this is one of the passages where we have it described that way, but the armor that we're supposed to put on, the battle that we're in. Just read a couple of verses here. Ephesians 6 and verse 10, finally be strong in the Lord and in the strength of his might, put on the full armor of God so that you may be able to stand firm against the schemes of the devil. Okay, and then he goes on describing this armor, that armor, and so on. So we're in a fight. And so it's the same thing for us. We need to be strong and courageous. we're not on a physical battlefield, but something that in a lot of ways may be more challenging. Mentally, emotionally, we're fighting this spiritual battle. And it's fought by kids in college classrooms. It's fought by people in the workplace. It's fought by friends hanging out and deciding what to do for recreation. All kinds of different ways we're fighting the spiritual battle. And so we need to be strong and courageous. So good lesson there for us to take from these instructions to Joshua. Okay, let me pause there again. Comments, questions, anything you want to add so far? Kenny?
There to like Ezra when he talks about he purposes in his heart.
Okay.
You know, part of that purposing to study the law, to do it, and to teach it. We see here meditating on it, studying it, careful to do according to the will, and then the law shall never depart your mouth, teaching it.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a good point. It's, focused on the word. We think, oh, Joshua, he just went out and fought. He did a lot of fighting. But notice how he's saying, here's the book of the law that shall not depart from your mouth. This is all based upon the word of God, the will of God. You're going to be leading the people in obeying me and my word. Great point. Okay, anything else? Okay, look at this next section here, 10 through 18. And remember that 2.5 tribes had already settled or were already granted land on the east side of the Jordan. So here's the Jordan River connecting these two bigger bodies of water. And 2.5 are going to settle on the east, and the rest of them are going to settle on the west. And so we're getting to a section talking about that. So verses 10 and 11, then Joshua commanded the officers of the people, saying, pass through the midst of the camp, and command the people, saying, prepare provisions for yourselves, for within 3 days you are to cross this Jordan to go in to possess the land which the Lord your God is giving you to possess it. Okay, so you can just imagine being on the banks of this Jordan River, and they're being told, get ready, it's time to go across. And we're going to cross over, and it's going to be time to start fighting. So if you can imagine the excitement, I mean, this is a long time ago, this is years in the making, that they're finally to the riverbanks, and it's time to cross over and start fighting. They've been wandering around the wilderness till their parents all died off, and they're finally here. This is a monumental time for this generation, and they shouldn't be cowards. I mean, their parents didn't have faith to do this. Now they're trying to summon up the energy, the zeal, the faith to go in and conquer what they need to conquer after these 40 years. We're not going to read verses 12 through 18, but basically he's just reminding them of the deal, reminding these 2.5 tribes, Reuben, Gad, half tribe of Manasseh. He's going to say, remember, we granted you this land, but the deal was you're not going to stay over here while we go over here and fight. You're going to cross with us. We're all going to fight together until all the land is conquered. And then you can come back over here and live. So leave your wives and kids over here. You're going to cross over there and help us with her, which makes sense. I mean, you wouldn't want to, everybody just settles where they are, where their land's going to end up being. And then by the end, the last tribe's fighting by themselves. So we're all together until this thing is completely done. And that's what he's reminding them there. So that's an arrangement way back in Numbers 32. Where they made that. And so they all agreed and said, yeah, we remember. We're going to do that, absolutely. Okay, and so that brings us through chapter 1. Anything you want to add? Any comments, questions about any of that? J.D.?
Faith to leave their families without all of the fighting men. All of the fighting men are gone.
Yeah.
And they're trusting that God will take care of them and that people won't come in. I mean, they are defended to the east by the desert. But still, there's paths from the north, paths from the south that people could come in.
Yeah, so many of these things that...
Not just the battles took faith, but things like that. These 2.5 tribes leaving their wives and kids over there. It's not like they can run home if something happens. They're across the river. They're hundreds of miles away. A lot of faith there. Good point. Anything else? JR?
For those three tribes that were on the eastern side... Didn't seem like I recall a lot of fighting for them. I just don't remember where that's at.
That would be, was that Deuteronomy or Numbers? They came up, let's see, let me go back to this one. So there were several over here, and these guys are mentioned a lot, the king of Sion, and kingdom of Og.
Oh, okay.
And so, yeah, they came and conquered these guys first, and so then it looks like this. And so when we get to Rahab here in a second, she's going to say, we heard about that. You guys already conquered everybody on the east over there.
Have any questions? Okay. Quiet.
And speaking of Rahab, she's not too far on the other side of the river, based on the images that we've seen in class.
Yeah, she's just across. You know, Jericho is right there, close to the river, and you know, they can see the river from Jericho. And so, and we're going to find out they've heard about not only the battles on the east, they heard about the Red Sea 40 years ago. And their hearts melted because of it. So however they heard about it, traveling, salesmen, whatever it was, word of mouth back then, you know, before Facebook, they heard about stuff. And they already knew about that, and their hearts were already melted. Okay, JR?
That was the last edition of the Pharaoh Express.
Okay. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they were wiped out in the Red Sea. Good. Okay, let's look in chapter 2 then and talk about Rahab and the spies here. Joshua 2 and verse 1, then Joshua, the son of Nun, sent two men as spies secretly from Shittim, saying, go view the land, especially Jericho. So they went and came into the house of a harlot whose name was Rahab and lodged there. It was told the king of Jericho, saying, behold, men from the sons of Israel have come here tonight to search out the land. And the king of Jericho sent word to Rahab, saying, bring out the men who have come to you, who have entered your house, for they have come to search out all the land. But the woman had taken and hidden the two men, and she said, yes, the men came to me, but I did not know where they were from. It came about when it was time to shut the gate at dark that the men went out. I do not know where the men went out. Pursue them quickly, and you will overtake them. But she had brought them up to the roof and hidden them in the stalks of flax, which she had laid out in order on the roof. So the men pursued them on the road to the Jordan, to the fords, and as soon as those who were pursuing them had gone out, they shut the gate. Okay, so these two Israelite spies find this woman who's sympathetic to the cause, and she hides them up there on the roof, and they avoid capture because of that. And this is one of the most interesting events recorded in the book, and maybe the Old Testament, and in this person of Rahab, who turns out to be a wonderful woman and a faithful woman, but it starts out by saying, look, she's a prostitute. She's a harlot. And here we just read about her telling a lie, she was, you know, her profession was a harlot. One commentary tells me this, in spite of various attempts through history to make Rahab an innkeeper rather than a prostitute, the normal meaning of the word here is prostitute. Okay, so you look at the Hebrew word and, you know, maybe we struggle with that. Well, how could she be a prostitute? Maybe that word means she was just an innkeeper and they went to stay in her inn. You know, all the translations, you look at all the English translations, they're pretty consistent. Harlot or prostitute is the word that they translate there. And there's several commentaries that say, yeah, that's the normal word used for that. So she was not just an innkeeper. She was a harlot, and that was wrong. But we all have done things wrong, and she needs to repent and come out of that. And we see her coming and living with Israel afterwards, and it seems that she did come out of that. Now, why did these guys go to the house of a harlot? Don't make more of that than there was. It's probably just they're trying not to get caught. And they thought, here's a place where travelers would go and maybe be undetected. And so they go, and verse 1 tells us they lodged there, trying not to attract much attention. It didn't work because obviously people come looking for them. I would imagine that you're a city on edge. She's going to reveal their hearts are already melted. The nation of Israel is camped across the river, so you're terrified. You're about to get wiped out, and so everybody's on edge. And anybody strange wandering around, everybody's, you know, you're going to notice. And so these guys were definitely noticed, and so she hides them in her house. We're going to keep talking about her and reading through the account here, but anything you want to say so far, first seven verses?
Being Israel out there, it always strikes me as such a massive force when Sennacherib is around Jerusalem, and 144,000 were killed.
Yeah.
This is 10 times that.
Yeah.
Something on that order, you know, a million of people or whatever it was, but it was a lot more than that.
Yeah.
Almost an unthinkable number of people.
Yeah, and in Jericho, you know, it's just a city. It's not a state. It's not a nation. So there's no way. They would need a coalition of a bunch of people to come together to try to resist Israel, And of course, going against God's never going to work anyway. But yeah, so they know they're toast, and they're on edge because of that, and rightly so. JR?
And I think Rahab herself can serve as twofold example for us. One, as sinners, especially when we're an alien sinner and we don't have any forgiveness, we can turn from those things. We can change from an entire lifestyle that she had, an entire income was based upon the choices she was making. So she had to change at some point. All indications because of her lineage in Christ is that she did. But also, that should be encouragement. No matter what kind of life we're living, we can choose to do good. We can choose to do right. We don't have to stay in whatever it is we've been in, no matter how involved it is. And the other is, we don't need to be looking at people who may be what I would call a true alien sinner, where they're just sinning. They have no idea. Either have no idea or they've chosen that life. And realize that if they want to, God will bless them with forgiveness just like someone else who maybe hasn't gone as far into that area. And we need to have the understanding, the grace, and the willingness to engage those people to see if they will.
Yeah.
They may not, but if they do, like Rahab, she was presented with a choice. It looks like in quick order, she knew enough to know, it's time to make a change.
Yeah, right. And that's one of my favorite
parts about this record is seeing this interesting woman and the faith that she had. You might say, a prostitute, they don't know anything. They're not religious at all. That's not the case. She has faith in the God of Israel. Let's keep reading here, verse 8. Now, before they lay down, she came up to them on the roof and said to the men, I know that the Lord has given you the land and that the terror of you has fallen on us and that all the inhabitants of the land have melted away before you. For we have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea before you when you came out of Egypt, and what you did to the two kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan, to Sihon and Og, whom you utterly destroyed. When we heard it, our hearts melted, and no courage remained in any man any longer because of you. For the Lord your God, he is God in heaven above and on earth beneath. Now therefore, please swear to me by the Lord, since I have dealt kindly with you, that you will also deal kindly with my father's household and give me a pledge of truth, and spare my father and my mother and my brothers and my sisters and all who belong to them, and deliver our lives from death. So the men said to her, our life for yours, if you do not tell this business of ours, and it shall come about when the Lord gives us the land that we will deal kindly and faithfully with you. Okay, let's pause the reading there again. Just notice some of what she is saying there. First of all, she's saying, for we have heard, in verse 10, we've heard about all this stuff that's happened. How have they heard? You know, the days before internet, word of mouth, it gets around and merchants and whoever's traveling along the ancient paths over there and taking news around was obviously a very effective means of communication. So again, they heard about right across the river. They heard about that. That would not be too surprising to know, but they heard about the Red Sea 40 years ago when they were fleeing Egypt. So word got around. She said, our hearts melted. She says several different times in that wording or something similar to it that we're terrified. And that's a very interesting thing. Hold your place. Go back to Exodus chapter 14 and 15. Exodus 14, this is the Red Sea. So God parts the waters. Israel goes through on dry ground. The Egyptian army pursues them. Israel gets out of the area. And then while the Egyptians are there, God lets the water come back in. And, of course, all the Egyptians just drown in the army is just completely wiped out. So it's just utter defeat. So that's in chapter 14. And then in Exodus 15, it's the song. The Israelites sing a song. You see in 15:1, Moses, the sons of Israel, sang this song. So they're singing a song about it. And then notice what is foretold in that song, verse 14. So I'm in Exodus 15 and verse 14. The peoples have heard, they tremble. Anguish has gripped the inhabitants of Philistia. Philistia, that's talking about over here in the promised land. They're going to be scared over there. Verse 15, then the chiefs of Edom were dismayed. The leaders of Moab, trembling, grips them. All the inhabitants of Canaan have melted away. Terror and dread fall upon them. By the greatness of your arm, they are motionless as stone until your people pass over, O Lord, until the people pass over whom you have purged. So this is foretelling. This is prophesying ahead of time the terror that is shooting forward into Canaan about the Israelites. And so 40 years later, we see this coming true as by Rahab's mouth. She's talking about that. Also, look in Exodus 23, just real quick. Let me throw another passage in here. Exodus 23 and verse 23. For my angel will go before you and bring you into the land of the Amorites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Canaanites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, and I will completely destroy them. Okay, so God is foretelling that. Now drop down to verse 27. I will send my terror ahead of you and throw into confusion all the people among whom you come. I will make all your enemies turn their backs to you. I will send hornets ahead of you so that they will drive out the Hivites, the Canaanites, and the Hittites before you. I will not drive them out before you in a single year, that the land may not become desolate and the beasts of the field become too numerous for you. I will drive them out before you little by little until you become fruitful and take possession of the land. How neat is that, that God, you know, he's got all the plan for all this. They're going to be scared to death of you. They're going to turn their backs and run. You might as well say with their tail between their legs. And I'm not even going to do it all at once, just piece by piece, because you don't want a bunch of wild animals coming in, and then you have a hard time living in the land. So God had it all worked out. They're going to come and live in that land. And then she says, he is God in heaven above and on earth beneath, which is an interesting phrase if you just think about Rahab, the culture in which she lived, this idolatrous pagan culture and probably polytheistic. You know, they probably believed in all different kinds of gods and everything. And maybe the words here are indicating that she's recognizing he's the only God, because he's the God in heaven above and earth beneath. You know, people had funny ideas back then, like there was a God of the mountains and a God of the plains and a God of this and that. And she's saying, you know, this sweeping thing, this doesn't hit us as strongly because we think of God as the universal God, probably with no problem. But that was not so with them. And so she's making this statement, probably indicating a little bit of a better understanding there. Even if she still believed in other gods, she's saying he's the main one. He's the head God. And then she said, please deal kindly with my father's household there in verse 12. And so you can tell in Joshua 2, verses 12 and 13, that she knows that Jericho's going to be destroyed. Everybody's going to be killed. She's already making plans. Please save my family. So she knows it's over. And she's just trying to get a ticket out of here. And pretty smart. She's got the wherewithal to try to rescue her family. So great story here. We're going to keep reading. But one of the reasons I love the Bible is for its honesty. You know, here's Rahab, a prostitute. You would not think that this is going to be the hero of the story, but the Bible just says, here's what happened. And, you know, the Bible doesn't describe people as this person was 100% good all the time, this person 100% bad all the time. It'll tell people about people like Rahab. She's a prostitute, but she recognized the God of Israel was the one true God, or the true God, at least, and she had faith that they were going to conquer Jericho. And so the Bible recognized, just tells it like it is. The Holy Spirit gives us a completely honest record of what happened. I just think that's such a beautiful thing about the Bible. Angel?
It shows how we're used to looking at people's outside, yeah, and their outside actions. God can look at their heart.
Yeah. And she was wrong, but there was more to her than just that sin that she engaged in. Mark?
I've never really thought about before what the other countries around them thought while the Israelites were wandering around. But it seems like from reading this back in Exodus that God was using the Israelites' own poor decisions, and that when he forced them to wander around like that, he was using that to brew terror all around them. All of these other countries were looking out there and thinking, these guys are still marching around. What are they doing?
Yeah.
We know that they are an incredible force and God is with them. And, you know, they're all just petrified the whole time. And then they march up to their border. And, you know, now God has got the whole plan worked out where it's exact.
Where are they going to end up? Yeah. Look at verse 15.
Then she let them down by a rope through the window, for her house was on the city wall, so that she was living on the wall. So that shows us something about the size of those walls. If you can live on them, you know, it's not a one-foot wall. This is a big old thing we're talking about, and with houses on the wall. Okay, let's read the rest. Verse 16, she said to them, go to the hill country so that the pursuers will not happen upon you, and hide yourselves there for 3 days until the pursuers return. Then afterward you may go on your way. The men said to her, we shall be free from this oath to which you have made us swear, unless when we come into the land you tie this cord of scarlet thread in the window through which you let us down, and gather to yourself into the house your father and your mother and your brothers and all your father's household. It shall come about that anyone who goes out of the doors of your house into the street, his blood shall be on his own head, and we shall be free. But anyone who is with you in the house, his blood shall be on the head, on our head if a hand is laid on him. But if you tell this business of ours, then we should be free from the oath which you have made us swear. She said, according to your words, so be it. So she sent them away, and they departed, and she tied the scarlet cord in the window. They departed and came to the hill country and remained there for 3 days until the pursuers returned. Now the pursuers had sought them all along the road but had not found them. Then the two men returned and came down from the hill country and crossed over and came to the Jordan, came to Joshua, the son of Nun, and they related to him all that had happened to them. They said to Joshua, surely the Lord has given all the land into our hands. Moreover, all the inhabitants of the land have melted away before us. Okay, so come back and bring that good report. So they think this is the ancient Joshua there. You know, there's like a modern city built up now, but there's an archaeological dig site there that they think is the original Jericho. And if that's where it was, then she tells the spies, go hide back here in the hills for 3 days. And then the pursuers go, and they're probably, you know, here's the Jordan River. It goes like this right over here. And so Israel's camped over here. So the pursuers are thinking those spies are going back to Israel. So they're searching over here. They come back from the search. And then after 3 days, the spies sneak around back over this way and get back to the camp and to Joshua. Okay, so we'll see her later. We're going to see her in chapter 6 when we get to chapter 6. And she's mentioned again there. And she is saved in the battle when Jericho is wiped out. And then she ends up in the lineage of Jesus, Matthew chapter 1 and verse 5. And she is the great-great-grandmother of King David and then the great-great-great-great-great-grandmother of Jesus himself. She's in his, one of the, I think there's four women in the lineage of Jesus listed there, and she is one of them. So interesting thing about Rahab. Okay, let me just bring up one more thing. Look in Hebrews chapter 11, and let's talk about the lying. What about that? Does Rahab's story show that God condones lying or that God condones being a prostitute? Because she lies, you know, I don't know where those guys went. She's got them hidden up on the roof. So is that okay? You know, a lot of times people use this to justify situation ethics, that, you know, you can break God's laws if it's good, if there's a situation that demands that, and or it would be good to do that. God knows how to judge things perfectly, and I certainly do not. But I don't believe that her commendation later in Scripture, we're going to look at these two passages, and her rescue from the battle means that God necessarily approved of the lying she did as part of that, or certainly not her manner of life in being a harlot. She's commended in the New Testament, but notice what she's commended for. This is Hebrews 11:31. By faith, Rahab the harlot did not perish along with those who were disobedient after she had welcomed the spies in peace. Okay, so that's what Hebrews 11 says. She welcomed the spies in peace. And by the way, what a great chapter to appear in. Hebrews 11, the hall of fame of faith. And here's Rahab remembered for the faith that she had in welcoming those spies in peace. And then turn a couple pages, James chapter 2 and verse 25. In the same way also, was not Rahab the harlot also justified by works when she received the messengers and sent them out by another way? Okay, so there she's commended for receiving the messengers, sending them out by another way. Now, it's true, between receiving them and sending them out, she lied. I don't know that we could take that and say, well, it's okay to lie, you know, if you're in a tough spot. I'm not sure we can. I don't feel comfortable preaching that. Let me put it that way, that means we can just bend God's laws when we need to. Again, she was a harlot too. It's possible she committed prostitution that day as well. And this is not commending her for that any more than it's commending her for lying. So I don't see Rahab's story justifies lying or situation ethics of any kind. She has a faith which caused her to receive the spies, to deal with them kindly, to receive them in peace, to say all the faithful things that we read about her saying, and then she sent them out another way. And it was her faith in combination with those works that I believe is being commended here. Keith?
Sometimes when I read this about Rahab and her listed as the harlot, I realize that Jesus was also known as the carpenter too, but he wasn't a carpenter in everything we're reading. We never read of him making anything with wood other than dying on a cross. I'm wondering if Rahab has a reputation from past that she's overcame. We're never going to find out.
Yeah.
But I'm wondering, because many times I feel in scripture and many times in modern day, we have reputations from past actions. And I don't know that there's a need to justify Rahab as much as she may just have a reputation.
Okay.
All right. All right. It seems to me that she is a woman who is seeing the correct path and trying to get there and making mistakes along the way. And, you know, we see that a lot in all kinds of other examples. You know, we see Peter denying Christ when he's on the cross. And he's not commended for that. He is, you know, spoken well of for a lot of other things. So just because, you know, she had some things that she was doing wrong, the things that she is doing right doesn't commend those things that she was doing wrong.
Okay. Yeah.
And God's able to look at her and commend the good things, which shows us something about God, and that's a very comforting thing for us. Kyle?
First of all, before I make the comment, absolutely God would not be in agreement with lying, any of those things. Obviously not being a harlot, that's, you can see that all through Scripture. But there's no doubt, on the other side of this, there's no doubt that God's involved in this. And so you can't just take God's footprint or handprint off of this situation. I don't think it was a mistake that these two men ended up where they did, and what came of it came of it. And, you know, I guess this is a hypothetical situation, but I will tell you that if I was in a situation where my life was in danger and I was given an option out, and I never intended to not, you know, hey, if you do this, then I'll let you go. Well, I'm going to tell you I'm going to do it. I'm going to lie. If you got a knife to my neck and you're telling me if you'll let me go, I won't call the cops, I'm going to lie to you. I'm not saying that God condones that. And again, that's not what I'm saying here. But she's trying to protect her family. She's trying to protect the lives of herself and her mom and dad and her brothers and sisters. And she recognizes that the God of all things, who is over all things, is fixing to basically place judgment on Jericho.
Yeah.
And I agree in part to what Mark said. She's trying to get to the right thing.
Yeah.
She recognizes, she sees the writing on the wall.
Yeah.
And all these other people here, they don't. And it's odd that they don't see that, but...
Yeah. And that's why I started out by saying,
God knows perfectly how to judge that. And I'm glad he's the judge, not me, because I can't figure out something. And that comes up in like, a, you know, World War II. If you're hiding a Jew, and then here comes the SS or whoever it was, the Germans, you know, do you say, yeah, Anne Frank is hiding, you know, or do you lie, or do you just try not to say anything? You know, what does God expect of a Christian in that situation? God's going to judge all those situations. I don't know what to say, but as far as a general rule, obviously lying is wrong. We know that much. Okay, Kaylin?
This is definitely, do the ends justify the means? And I mean, I don't think that God needs us to make up our own means to get the right ends.
Okay.
I personally don't believe there's ever a situation where he would need us to use means that go against anything that he's commanded us for some end. And I also, that kind of also makes me think of the passage where Lot's daughters make him drunk and then they sleep with him, and it says that we may preserve the family line or something to that effect.
Yeah.
And the Bible mentions that, and it doesn't say, and that was wrong or anything like that, but just because the Bible is telling this part of the story does not mean it's condoning it. And again, maybe you could say, oh, that's a good thing. They wanted to keep their father's line going. But obviously the way they did that was horrible.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. It's an interesting situation that it's a nuanced thing, that it's not like she was just completely good. There's some stuff that we say, oh, I don't know about that. So it's interesting. Daniel?
I'll give credit to my wife for bringing this up, but whether she would have lied, whether she lied or she had told the truth, God's will still would have been done.
Okay.
You know, the whatever would have happened, God was in control of the situation.
That's a good point.
Whatever she did, God would have used it to satisfy his will.
Yeah, I mean, the story could have been, and this will be my last thing, we're out of time, but she might have said, they're on the roof, and then an angel comes down and kills everybody and spirits these guys away, and that could have been what we read in Joshua 2. Who knows what would have happened there if God would have intervened like that. But this is what happened. This is what's recorded. Interesting. Okay, so next week, Lord willing, we'll start talking about they're going to cross the river, and then it's going to be time to have the battle. The walls are going to fall down. Thank you for your attention tonight.